You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hello, and welcome to an author debriefing from the International Spy Museum. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Here at the museum, we get the most interesting authors, including journalists, scholars, former spies, and intelligence officers coming in to speak with our visitors and answer questions about their latest works dealing with espionage, intelligence, and other national security issues. Please join me in listening to another of our selected hour-long author debriefings. We're joined today by Dr. Genevieve Lester, who is the author of the new book, When Should State Secrets Stay Secret? Accountability, Democratic Governance, and Intelligence. Dr. Lester is currently a research fellow and lecturer at the University of California Washington Center and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Recently, she was visiting assistant professor in the Security Studies Program, coordinator of intelligence studies, and senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her work concerns security and accountability, with a particular focus on intelligence oversight. She holds a PhD and MA in political science from the University of California at Berkeley, an MA in International Economics and International Relations from the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and a BA in History from Carleton College. She has been a fellow of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London and a Fulbright Scholar in Berlin. And she's an unbelievable overachiever. So welcome, Jen. Thank you for taking the time to join us here at the International Spy Museum.
Thank you so much for having me.
So our audience tends to be budding writers, authors themselves, students of intelligence. And so I always try to ask our authors about their process, the sources they use, their methodology, and of course, with any book of intelligence, how they dealt with the secrecy and classification issues. So how did this book come together?
Well, this book is actually a revision of my doctoral dissertation, and it came together rather accidentally, actually. Mainly, I met a series of intelligence officers while working on my research here in Washington, D.C., and they were incredibly generous and were willing to talk to me. And so basically, I would have to say that there was the grand schema was that I was able to have access to these individuals, and then we built the project around that. So that is how this whole thing started.
So as a historian who we always are worried about bias in our sources and our methodology, were you perhaps concerned that as your primary source, which getting intelligence officers to be a primary source is fantastic, but maybe not necessarily the most objective sources. Is that something that crossed your mind at any point?
Constantly. And one of the things I did in addition to all of my other overachievements, as you put it, was to work on methods. I do a lot of methods work in political science because of these issues. And especially if you're doing heavily qualitative work that is not the norm in political science, it is complicated to put together a methodological package for something like this or a methodological framework. I should also make a comment on the genesis of the project when it comes to methods, because when we originally put together, my committee and myself, put together this project on accountability, it was on external oversight. I thought, to balance out the external view, that it would be really important to have the internal view. And therefore, it's almost the opposite of what you're suggesting.
Right.
I got very lucky with amazingly generous members of the intelligence community who were willing to give me a lot of time. And I'm not kidding. I'm kind of a little compulsive about these things. So I interviewed many of them many, many, many times and had them check their quotes and all of this type of thing. But as I said, it is almost the opposite in that I wanted to get the internal view because, as you suggest, the secrecy of this, the opacity, ambiguity of intelligence operations, that makes it very complicated to even understand what's happening. So how can we understand how oversight is happening if we don't understand the internal piece?
Well, the external versus internal is one of the real key components of this book that makes it really interesting. Because most of the work done in the past has really been limited to
maybe one branch of government. A lot of people look at the legislative, you know, the two committees, and very few look at the other branches of government, the executive, the judicial, but even within the CIA, within the agencies themselves. And I think this openness to look at both inside and outside is a really interesting component of this book. And really, am I wrong to suggest that the question that you're facing is one of accountability, is one of oversight versus things like openness or transparency? Those are kind of more secondary, even tertiary to the overall topic.
Well, they're definitely fundamental components of accountability, but the book itself, I think, touched upon this beautifully, which is how to expand our view. How do we expand our perspective on oversight? And that's why I looked at all three branches of government. And also, as you mentioned, looked within the agency, and the book does focus predominantly on CIA, because that was the agency that I was most interested in. So it was to broaden the perspective so that we have not only all three branches of government, but this internal piece, but also looking at how the different branches and different mechanisms within these branches interact with each other.
Right.
And that sets up the framework for the discussion. But what I wanted to also touch upon is this idea of looking into our assumptions about accountability. And that's another thing the book hopefully does. Yeah. we can only be optimistic that this comes across, which is to question some of our assumptions. And within the American democracy, there are certain things we take for granted or expect. And one would be that greater oversight would equal greater transparency. And that is the story, part of the story, and there are many different themes that run throughout.
Right.
But one of them is this true? So as oversight mechanisms in all three branches, but especially the external ones, as they develop and mature, are they creating greater openness or rather the reverse?
Well, and I was going to touch upon this almost as like the last question, because it's a big conclusion, a big premise of your book, and that you somewhat paradoxically conclude that it's the opposite.
Exactly. And that is exactly that gradually, as these mechanisms mature and become institutionalized, they help create almost a secret environment. And I want to make this point very clear. I'm not saying this is a scary, bad thing or a conspiracy or something like that that's negative. Actually, I would try very hard in this book, again, hoping I achieve this, to be objective and to take all of these viewpoints into account. But yes, that is what I come... The final conclusion actually is to me, which is that as these mechanisms, I keep using the word mechanism, that would be the oversight committees
right.
in both chambers and the FISA court, for example. But that as they grow, this system becomes institutionalized in a way that actually aids in the continuance of secrecy.
Which flies in the face of what a lot of Americans would perceive, that these organizations like the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, like the FISA courts, like internal accountability and oversight groups will make it to where the Americans may have a better say or a larger dog in the fight when it comes to the intelligence communities. And you're arguing the opposite, really, that these are actually institutionalizing secrecy, making it easier for these agencies to maintain secrecy, to make them less open, less transparent.
And I'm saying this, again, without the negative connotation.
Right.
I'm trying very hard not to have the negative connotation there, because I think that we must, and as you mentioned at the very beginning of this, the difficulty of doing academic work in this space is that we do need secrecy around these programs. It's a tension in the democracy. How open should these things be when we have operational needs that require secrecy? So I'm not saying, oh, this becomes closed and bad and
right.
removed from the American people in a negative, intentional way. I'm saying that this is what comes out of this process as these mechanisms develop, but also that we have to understand as Americans, and I have to admit, I keep coming back to Americans, the American democracy, that type of thing. This book is particularly U.S. focused.
Right.
But that is the core piece of this, which is, I think, core to almost any discussion of intelligence. How do you handle that friction between need for operational secrecy and the American democratic expectation of openness when it comes to our government and the people who speak for us
right.
and make decisions for us?
We talked about the fact that you look at both internal and external accountability oversight. Let's start on the internal side, and then we'll work our way through it. I often get asked by students who come here to the Spy Museum who are looking at a career one day, like, what do I study to get into the CIA? And the automatic answer, political science, history, international relations, nowadays more about the STEM subjects, mm-hmm. science, technology, mathematics. But you could potentially say become a lawyer and you can find yourself a pretty good job in CIA. You talk a lot about law and about the fact, quotes from several directors and others that say lawyers are everywhere nowadays. And I think that's one of the interesting concepts in this book, that agencies, of course, the CIA specifically, operate at the margins of legality. But because of that, they have to be extra conscious about what is actually legal versus illegal.
I'd like to make just a distinction there, though. The agencies aren't operating at the edge of domestic law within this country. But that's another tension. We see that in order for them to do their function that we expect them to do and to complete their mission, they are breaking foreign laws.
Right.
But they are adhering to domestic laws, just to make that point clear, or there'll be some people after me. but yes, so the reason I point this out a lot in this book is to negate or to try and argue against this concept or this sense that the agencies are rogue, that they're running off doing, especially CIA, because there, it has this mythologic piece to it, that they're what myth and reality means within the context of the CIA is something that's discussed here a lot at the museum. Mm-hmm. We see James Bond, and then we also see actual operational tools.
Right.
So we have these two sides within the discussion of intelligence. But to just come back to the question you asked me about the legal piece is that you first of all are balancing these two sides. You're balancing adhering to domestic law, bureaucratic procedure, institutions, oversight. And then you're also, though, charged again with conducting activities in a way that, and sometimes are breaking foreign law. So that tension is pretty crucial.
Right. You said sometimes. I mean, there's not a country in the world where it's legal to commit espionage. So, yeah.
I mean, to be a little subtle here.
No, Peter Ernest, our executive director, constantly says, like, his job was to go overseas and convince people to break their nation's laws.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting dynamic. And I think within the CIA specifically, there's a very interesting dynamic between two internal accountability organizations full of lawyers, and that's the General Counsel of the CIA and the Inspector General of the CIA. And you point out that for many people in the agency, the General Counsel is an ally, is somebody they can turn to for legal advice, where the IG in many cases is seen as more in an adversarial relationship to many people in the CIA. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic?
Definitely. So in the OGC, that is where the attorneys within the CIA are, that's where they're based. And they are embedded at every level, though. There are lawyers dealing with every part of programming, especially things that are sensitive, such as covert action. So you have this sense of partnership with the attorneys. And I don't want to make the point too strong about an adversarial relationship with the office of the Inspector General, but there's definitely some friction there because mm-hmm. that role, that office is charged with following up on potential malfeasance, accountability issues, that type of thing internally. So, and also that role has several different components. So you're doing audits and reports and that type of thing, but you're also doing investigations should there be some suspected wrongdoing. What some steps have been made recently to make that more of an ombudsman role, so that would be a place of recourse should internal employees need to express some anxiety about activities, that type of thing.
Right.
But there's definitely more friction with that role because of this audit, this type of experience. But also just to move beyond that from the internal piece of the statutory inspector general is this dual reporting role that I would say is where the friction point is with that particular role. Because in this case, you have an inspector general who reports internally through his director, the director of CIA, DCIA, but also is responsible for reporting to the Hill, to the congressional oversight committees. So in a sense, it could be argued that this is a split loyalty.
Right.
That is this crossing the boundaries between separation of branches? Is this even appropriate governance? If you have this individual, I use the individual, there's an office and there's a lot of other staff, but this person must report in two different directions. And some of the senior members within the agencies have really, really pushed back on this, saying that this is breaking apart boundaries that are appropriate for good governance in terms of crossing over these boundaries.
Well, you tell the story in your book about the real friction between the IG and the CIA during Michael Hayden's tenure as the DCIA. A man named John Helgerson was the IG, and Hayden actually launched an investigation against his own IG, mm-hmm. which it seems like, you know, Wonderland levels of crazy.
Well, and that... I'm not sure I quite put it that way.
I like putting things in a way. I don't get in trouble with this, so I like putting it in ways that...
I think what it does expose, though, is how these mechanisms grow and how they get strengthened. So if you do have a statutory, so this is by law that this happens this way, that there is a dual reporting requirement, but if you undercut that role, and I'm not saying that that's what happened, but I'm saying this dynamic can weaken or strengthen or allow the position to be weakened or strengthened. If you've got the DCIA, for example, undercutting that role, saying, oh, we don't think your behavior is appropriate, we're going to have that you be investigated by another individual, that really weakens that mechanism. And this can get very granular. It comes down to personal levels. It gets personal interactions, personalities. I think also there's, and I talk about this in the book quite a bit, institutional culture, what the expectations are, how the different divisions take their responsibilities and how that works and how there is friction actually. And this is quite normal in bureaucracies, but I would argue more distinctive within intelligence agencies where there's a lot of danger involved, right, that these cultures can conflict with each other or there's friction. And that was one of the problems with that particular incident that you mentioned, that one particular group felt singled out.
You mentioned in the book something maybe people not think about as oversight, and that's counterintelligence as a means of oversight. Can you talk a little bit about how that dynamic works? And of course, can counterintelligence oversight go too far? And of course, Angleton is the great example of where you can take it a little beyond where it should go.
So with counterintelligence, I talk about this within the internal aspect, right, of the book, just that there's a piece of this, and there are many aspects of counterintelligence. And I would also say that it is one of the most opaque pieces, at least for me in my studies, how to understand how it works, what the pieces of it are, and what effectiveness is. Because you ultimately, speaking of, I can't remember what you said, crazy Wonderland.
Yes.
It can get you into a place, and Angleton is a good example of this, where you are second guessing everything, right, and you're wondering who can be on your side, who's on your side, who is supporting the mission, maybe if there's a potential mole, those types of things. And I think with intelligence agencies that are closed off from the external world, this can get exacerbated because you must be able to depend on your internal cohort, right, to support your activities, because you are removed from the regular openness of bureaucracies. So there, right, are many pieces of it. I'm not sure if I'm getting...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and you know, certainly it's hard enough to operate because of all the external pressures that you have that we'll talk about here in a second, without trusting the people around you and without kind of coming together as an agency in your own. And that could potentially set you back pretty significantly if you can't, you know, trust your own IG, you can't trust your own counsel, you can't trust your own, you know, employees. And from a counterintelligence perspective, I imagine that makes life very, very difficult for these agencies.
Well, and I would just make one point here that the fundamental to the institutional culture of these agencies is trust. The level of trust is very high. The boundaries to entry are so high, the barriers to entry, right, polygraphs, background checks, giving up a lot of your, what we would assume are freedoms in a democracy, financial checks, this type of thing.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest ones now, the financial checks, yes, because you that's the way that people are going to get to you if they're going to turn you is through money in many cases.
Exactly. Well, the whole point is to expose any vulnerabilities. Right. So it used to be, it's changed a lot. And I find that actually very interesting too, that it used to be, for example, homosexuality was a friction point. And now, as you mentioned, the financial piece is one of the most crucial things in terms of choosing who is part of this world and who gets to stay in this world. So I think the fundamental assumption is not that you don't trust. The fundamental assumption is that you do trust. And so when you have somebody like Angleton, who went so far in the other direction that he was finding bad actors everywhere, right, in his own mind, yeah, and that's a whole other discussion, right, about his whole track record on this stuff. But I do think that you really see the culture tear apart in those moments, because it's crucial in this environment to be able to trust.
Well, because there are many, many external factors. Let's look at some of the external pressures being placed upon the agencies. And let's start, you know, let's go back to fifth grade civics, and let's start with the different branches of government. Let's start with the executive branch. You have a term inside this book that I want you to kind of talk a little bit about, and that's oppositional oversight. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of lay down what we're talking about with that terminology?
So with oppositional oversight, and that's core to the relationship between the executive and Congress. And this is a term I developed because I was interested in seeing how the intelligence oversight mechanisms develop over time. So this is about how you see, and this is very normal for the development of institutions, that they develop incrementally in short spurts, usually driven by some external activity, some political event, that type of thing. And so when I say oppositional in this means that it is the tension, that there is a tension between the executive and legislative branches on how these things should work. So you have the executive and the agencies, the security services are part of the executive. They support the executive. They support those decision makers. So that information is owned by the executive. But when it comes to oversight, it is, I would say, borrowed by the legislature.
Right.
And so this tension has come up in that executive doesn't always want to share certain information. Congress doesn't always want to know about intelligence activities. It's not as black and white as one would assume, that the executive wants to keep everything secret,
right,
and Congress wants to get everything out of them, and that one side's good or one side's bad. The point I make throughout, and I hope this is clear in the book, is that we're not talking bad or good. These are not value judgments on these things. We're talking about relational,
right,
components. And that's crucial to the oppositional framework that I create here, which is to say, this isn't always straightforward. You have Congress sometimes not, as I mentioned, not wanting to know stuff or not claiming responsibility once they do know stuff. And we've seen recent examples of that.
Right.
And in some cases, you have the executive wanting to open information up to the public, to the other mechanisms, because they want cover, for example,
right,
or blame sharing.
Yeah.
Those types of things that, well, if we're in this, we want the other branches to know about this, or especially Congress. I think the opposition relationship really is between executive and Congress, according to my framework. And that is, that comes back to this idea of blame in many cases, because we are, as you mentioned at the very outset, talking about activities that are pushing the boundaries. And as all intelligence activities really do, or secret activities, or activities that are intended to fill these really dangerous missions.
A lot of the potential issues that we talk about when it comes to the CIA and governance and oversight really stem from its founding, going all the way back to 1947. And the ambiguity behind which it was given its legal rights and its functions. And you talk about a term that's bandied about for, I think, for political scientists, and I'm not one, but I play one on TV sometimes.
You said that with a certain tone.
Yes. I think it somewhat goes back to the Constitution itself, where you have the necessary and proper clause in Article 1, Section 8. See, I can play one on TV. Well, this is the concept of the fifth function of CIA, where during the National Security Act of 1947, it was this ambiguous clause that kind of gave it the necessary and proper kind of idea that Congress was given in the original Constitution. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it's function caused five? Problems over time?
I think the problem with Function 5 is that it's exactly what you say. It's very ambiguous, and it basically is a sort of a bucket term. It's a place to put all the other activities that CIA is involved in, and that is the home of covert action. So originally, it was very unclear exactly, was assumed to some degree that those types of things would happen within the CIA, but it wasn't clear. It wasn't delineated very carefully at the outset what exactly the agency would be doing. There was a lot of tension about, should there even be a CIA or an intelligence collection agency in a peaceful world? And that's the thing, too, to remember, that I think the way the genesis of intelligence has come from conflict.
Right.
So World War II, you have a military intelligence structure after World War II. Well, do we still need this activity? So Function 5 sort of was a place for all the rest of the activities to go without having to delineate what they were. And that over time became complicated, because when it comes to covert action, and covert action comes up a lot, and it comes up a lot in my book, it comes up a lot everywhere, because it is an active process. So what we're doing when we do covert action is we are actively disrupting a foreign environment. And that might be environmental, it might be political, it might be economic. But what covert action is something that is basically penetrating another country's sovereignty. and breaking laws. So that covert action and the fifth function, what role covert action should have, what constitutes appropriate behavior in that context, and how it's overseen have all been very big questions within this space. And I think that the ambiguity of function five from the very beginning had several different effects. One was to make it easy for the executive to basically use this tool however it chose to, but also made it complicated for overseers in understanding exactly how much they should be requiring right. from this. And again, all of these questions are complicated ones. And I don't mean to say that just because I did complicated work and that makes me extra smart about all this, but just that there are many, many pieces. And I argue that in the book, that there are so many pieces of this that are early assumptions of congressional oversight is the only way to do this, or that spies are running around and rogue and not telling the truth, that none of these things are black and white, and none right. of them are that clear cut, that it's relational, that the branches work together, sometimes oppositionally, and you also have a lot of internal dynamics that complicate right. the whole way this plays out.
Since 1947, when the CIA was formed, there have been a lot of actions by the executive branch, whether they were orders from the National Security Council or executive orders that have redefined or continue to define the role of the CIA and the intelligence community. One of the most interesting ones to most people, and certainly to me, is Executive Order 12333 or 12333.
This
was early during the Reagan administration, but it's still intact more or less 30 years later. And this is one that really helps to define the role of the White House and the government in covert action. And can you talk a little bit about that executive order? Because that's the one a lot of people point to as the one that takes this ambiguity and tries to define it a little bit better.
Well, it basically tries to lay out what the appropriate roles are of the different agencies and how they should interact with each other. And that's, again, getting back to what you had originally asked me about, which is the ambiguity and how and the issues of Function 5. It is trying to nail down how not only what each agency is responsible for, but how they interact with each other and how they're managed. And I think it brings to the fore the role of the National Security Council in many ways and the coordinating role that it plays in terms of bringing together this information in support of presidential decision-making, particularly.
And particularly with covert action. I mean, it kind of says that the White House is controlling covert action, a little bit of presidential ownership.
And that is very interesting that you bring that up, because the plausible deniability question is core to that. And the fact that one of the crucial pieces of this and covert action has always been, and I mentioned that this is active intelligence. I just want to sort of point out the distinction I'm making there, which is active activity versus right. collection, for example, collection and analysis, which is another part of the intelligence process. So we've got people collecting information all the time and analyzing it and sending it through the chain to the policymaker. But this other piece, this covert action, is this active piece. And therefore, it becomes very core to accountability and to the oversight process. And also was used as this intermediate tool. You can use covert action because you don't have to take responsibility for it. By definition, it is something that we do not acknowledge.
Right.
And therefore, it is not a diplomatic activity or necessarily a military activity that's overt. It's this other third road. And that has become very seductive for decision makers over the course of time, because why would you not want to use this tool if right. you don't have to own up to it? So when we get back to the ownership piece of this, that has been the core of development over time to say, okay, well, we don't acknowledge this publicly, but internally within the system, the president must own this. There must be a person who's taking responsibility for this. And therefore, in 1974, there was legislation passed that made the president have to sign what is called a finding and send. And the finding says this activity is necessary for national security. And here it lays out what it is. They varied in length, notably getting longer over the course of time, as is usual in a bureaucracy.
Right.
And they get sent to Congress. So Congress is fully briefed on covert actions that are being done by the administration. So what that does, again, is why it doesn't break down external, so by the external responsibility for this. So we're not saying to country A, we're doing this, you get right. to know about this, but we are saying internally, this goes all the way up to the top, to the top elected official in the administration who is taking responsibility for this particular activity.
Well, you just mentioned Congress, and we couldn't have planned this transition any better, because I'd love to move on to some of the legislative branch ideas here. And you talked about informing Congress. There's an interesting clause, if you want to call it that, the idea about timeliness, about how quickly do you need to inform Congress. of your plans in covert action. Certainly, members of Congress may want even to be informed of a planned covert action before the fact, but the laws say a different thing. The laws say at some point in a timely manner, whatever that means, you have to inform Congress of an ongoing covert action. Where does this come from, and what in God's name does timeliness mean?
Timeliness is a very interesting question and another place of ambiguity in this great game of accountability and oversight. The fact is, there are a lot of assumptions built into, or a lot of assumptions that there would be leaks, that type of thing. So the fewer people who know about these things, the better, has always been the assumption. So, which just makes a certain kind of sense. So there has been pushback, and this gets back to the oppositional relationship, where Congress is saying, well, we want to know about these things, or some Congress people have wanted to know about these things in a certain time frame, and we're going to build that into legislation so that you can't tell us a year later that you undertook a covert action. You must do this in this sort of way. So timely still has ambiguity around it.
Right.
And I think that what I would say about that is I think it comes back to how that plays out in practice is it comes back to trust between the branches and that they do generally want to abide by the rule. There's good faith here, but the executive has traditionally over the course of time not wanted to be bound by particular external restrictions when it comes to the timeliness of this. And timeliness in the context of findings is one piece of this, but timeliness or temporality is a question I talk about in the book quite a bit because it affects how accountability works. And by this, I mean, when are you informed?
Right.
And not just are you informed 24 hours before it starts or 48 hours after a particular program starts, but overall when? And what is your recourse? So if you hear about something, so covert actions is a particular specific case, but if you hear about a program that you don't approve of a year later,
right,
what do you do about that? And yeah, we know that it, as good fifth grade civic students, as you pointed out, we know that the main tool is through the budget. You cut funding if you don't want something, or you say, we will cut funding unless we can change the program in this way, or, you know, there are particular inputs. And there are knowledgeable people who are working on this stuff. It's not like these programs are not being overseen by people who they understand what, you know, the technological pieces of this to at least a large extent. But that really brings up this other question of what do you do to change behavior then if you find out a year later? And by behavior, I don't mean individuals necessarily,
right,
but by we don't approve of this program or recent programs that have come up, such as the torture,
right,
and interrogation, that type of thing. And when do you find out about it? And there's been a discussion of that. When were overseers told? How much did they know? Did they understand what was happening? All of these questions come to play. Again, it's a kind of a moving game that's happened, or a moving mosaic, I would say, that is changing in dynamic motion all the time.
Well, and I think outside the Beltway bubble, people that live this every day, there's a perception that it's relatively straightforward, relatively simple, the relationship between the agencies and the legislative branch in Congress. You have these two committees, one in the House and one in the Senate, set up in the late 1970s. You have HPSI and you have SSCI. They don't want to be called CISI anymore.
But we call them that anyway.
We call them that anyway, but I was trying to be nice. Set up to try to do this kind of oversight. Within those committees, you certainly have the leadership of the committees themselves. And so you have things like the Gang of Four and the Gang of Eight to where you can inform less people than the whole Congress. I can understand, again, living here, that you don't want to inform the junior Congress member from Idaho because he may go directly to the local newspaper or whatever. No offense to whoever in the world is the junior congressperson from Idaho. I'm pulling a name out of the hat. But I think what people might be surprised to find out about is that after 9/11 and the ability to try to consolidate the intelligence community and make it more streamlined and make it more cohesive, we got kind of went the opposite direction when it comes to the legislative branch. Instead of just two committees and small groups overseeing the intelligence agencies, you know, you say in your book there are 17 committees now that have some dog in the fight, that have some little bit and piece of intelligence work. That seems unwieldy. That how can oversight possibly happen with that much going on?
Well, I think it's basically that you're sharing this mosaic out into the world. You're not out into the world. Let me take that back. But that there are different pieces of it. There's appropriations that come through defense. There are different aspects of this. But I would say that it's still, That became more problematic when it deals with, for example, the Department of Homeland Security that is overseen by about 80 committees, or 80 committees have as a dog in the fight, or have an interest one way or the other. And that's obviously because of the number of components and all the different types of activities that are happening there. I still argue, yes, it's not as streamlined as it could possibly be, but you do really have centralization in HPC and SSCI. You do have, that is where the knowledge base is for these types of activities. That's where the responsibility is. Those committees authorize the budgets. And they are the ones who are going through all these programs. And the way it's set up is they have staffers who are responsible for continually interacting with the agencies. This is not, it is not a process that is opaque from within side. They're back channeling, they're talking, they have very deep relationships. And in many cases, and this can be problematic in its own way, but the staffers tend to be drawn through the intelligence community. So they have some awareness there. And just to make a point about that is, I think everyone within the Beltway knows, but maybe not outside, that the staff work is where this stuff happens.
Right. I mean, I was going to bring the idea up, but I mean, a lot of staffs in Congress, not a lot, but some are staffed by political lackeys, about people who know more about politics than necessarily about whatever subject area that they're in. But intelligence and foreign relations and some of these more important national security committees, you know, these are people drawn from the community, from state, from these are professionals. And they're the ones that do a lot of the heavy lifting. Now, saying that, I wanted to bring up this idea with you, because I think you could certainly address it. Until recently, SSCI, which is one of the most prominent committees, had a really good relationship with the intelligence communities. I mean, Dianne Feinstein, DIFI, who until very recently was the chair of SSCI until Congress, the Senate flipped. It amazed a lot of people when she came out as strongly as she did about the enhanced interrogation, the torture report, because she had been seen as a huge proponent of the intelligence community and somebody who was willing to say, look, yes, only 4 or 8 of us are hearing what's going on, but trust me, they know what they're doing. They're doing in the best interest of the country. And then for her to just go 180 degrees in the opposite direction was a bit of a shock for some of us here in the bubble.
I think that it was a shock for sure, because I think there are a couple different issues here. And I just wanted to step back one step to talk about this concept of capture. So that, as you point out, and as I mentioned too, that these staffers are professionals. They're in many cases drawn from the community, that type of thing. So one of the fears has always been with these committees that there'll be too much buy-in, that the committees themselves won't have enough objectivity and separation from the actual activities of the intelligence community, because either the individuals themselves were part of it, or they have an affinity for it, for intelligence activities, I mean, in that case. So this is a concern when it comes to staff. It's also a concern when it comes to the members. And definitely, Senator Feinstein has been a huge proponent of the intelligence community for the duration of her tenure. And I think that's inarguable. And I think it was a shock when this tension, shall I say, about the torture report, that type of thing, emerged. And I think that it has several different factors. It was mainly a political problem. And I think this I say with we're not best friends, she and I, so I don't have any internal secret knowledge of that. But I think there was tension politically within the committee, within SSCI, because the Republicans thought this was a politicized activity, this report that they were developing over the course of several years. And they split apart when it came to generating it. And that's one piece of this. Whether those activities should even be discussed was another question. And then there's another question of the relationship between, and this is crucial to oversight because it gets very granular, it gets very personal, and that is the relationship between DCIA Brennan and Senator Feinstein. And that is where I think the real friction came out, because he lied to Congress. You're not supposed to do that.
Right.
So in addition to not supposed to be, not, to having that actually be illegal, I think she felt personally affronted. And I think it was, and I don't know this in terms of, I'm not friends, like I mentioned, with either of them personally, but that I think it offended her and humiliated her.
You're
and
not
I think,
friends with anybody.
Objectivity.
Not Brennan,
objectivity.
No, DIFI, I see how it is.
But I do think that this, that came down to a series of political tensions, and internally to the committee, but also the inter-branch relationship here. And I think that Senator Feinstein was offended, because I do feel that she feels that she's always been a great supporter of the community and its ventures, and was very willing to stand up for the intelligence activities of our intelligence community.
So let's move on to easily the least well understood of the branches, the judiciary. Supposedly, you know, again, going back to fifth grade physics, you're supposed to have a balance of power. You're supposed to have three equal branches of government that all check each other. But this hasn't been the case historically when it comes to intelligence work. Today we have what many people have heard of, the FISA courts, but rarely can you find anything historically that even remotely comes close to this kind of oversight from the judiciary before this. Am I wrong to make that assumption?
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that it goes back to the genesis of all these mechanisms. So as we've been talking about fairly extensively, HPSI and SSCI, or SSCI, were stood up in the 70s. And right after that, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was passed in 1978. So that all three of these creations, these mechanisms, were put in place following revelations that there had been abuses, intelligence abuses in this country. And this ran the gamut. Some of them are ridiculous. Some of them were such as stories being told of putting explosives in Castro's cigar,
right,
or, but more pointedly in this case, to domestic intelligence abuses.
Right.
And this is, I'll get back to your point in one second. I just want to explain the backstory to why FISA is what it is and why it's set up the way it is, which was that in the mid 70s, and we have to think of the political context of that time. Watergate had happened. The country was embroiled in Vietnam still. There's a lot of dissatisfaction and a lot of lack of trust in government institutions. And then Seymour Hersh in the New York Times outs the agencies, Bureau, Agency, NSA, by saying all these things have been happening and they've been directed against the American people. And this is something that is very important to think about when in the external, internal conversation about oversight, because we as Americans tend not to worry so much, frankly, if we're going to blow up Castro's cigar, even though it makes us laugh. But when it comes to our domestic populations,
right,
that is where the real issues come up. And that makes a lot of sense. We want to protect our own freedom and privacy and all of that came up again, of course, with Snowden. So the 1978 Act was to figure out a way to make foreign intelligence collection within this country be overseeable, make it accountable, because there had been wiretapping, there had been other activities,
right,
there had been infiltration of student groups, anything that at that point looked like it could be a threat to United States safety or at that time. And we have to remember that as we go through history, and you know this much more than I do, the threat environment of the time creates a political environment that makes these things seem rational, even though when we might return later and think that they were crazy
right,
wonderland, as you pointed out.
Right.
But with FISA, so that is a way of streamlining how you get an order to wiretap somebody to collect foreign intelligence information within this country.
So one of the interesting arguments about FISA that people have been making over the past couple of years, certainly you hear this from the left, from people like the ASOU, is that FISA is just a rubber stamp, that FISA court requests are never denied. In fact, as you write in the book, only one single FISA request has had to be kicked up to what was called the FISA review court, the appeals court for when FISA denies a request, and one since 1978. So to me, you know, I may be leaning a little left myself. It seems like FISA just has no oversight whatsoever. I mean, I know it's not as black and white as that, but can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Well, being a good Berkeley PhD, I lean a little left myself. But in this case, I would say that there are two sides to this argument, of course. There's that side, the side that whether you want to put it on the political spectrum is its own question, but that is this a rubber stamp or is this an effective mechanism? The other side, and I would argue that it is effective in this way, which is, or its strength is not seen because it's not apparent why that happens, why so few orders have been turned down. And that is because there's an iterative process. The process is extremely lengthy to get one of these orders. So it goes through the Justice Department, has to be signed off, it has to be sent over to these courts, and is checked off again layer upon layer of individuals are checking off these orders, order requests, order applications as they go to the court. And if the FISA court has an issue with these particular orders, they send them back. More information, more detail. Why are we doing this? What's the importance of this particular activity, that type of thing? So I would suggest that there are two sides. Of course, we can always say, oh, it's rubber stamp. They just, no matter what, will say yes. That's not the case, though, because the institutional process is so deeply involved that they basically fix the mistakes as they happen. And they ask for more information. And they, again, iterate between the different individuals.
So the process is so vetted. The requests go through so many channels that the court themselves can look at stuff and tell you if they're going to pass it or not, not unofficially. And so anything that actually gets in front of the court for an official ruling has gone through such a lengthy process that it's not a surprise necessarily.
That is the argument.
Okay.
It's a little opacity to the secret court, needless to say. But yes, the argument is that the process is so long. And this has been a problem, a perceived problem, definitely when technology is speeding up. We are needing different types of tools. If we're going to be wiretapping, if you're going to be tracking a terrorist, for example, abroad, those types of things. Is this process, this is a fundamental question about the judiciary and FISA and its effectiveness, is the process too onerous to support what we are trying to do here, which is complete omission? And I think that that's very important to think about, that it can be very easy to get on the side of too far in support, and you can't ever support accountability too much, but just to forget that the operational piece of this is what the crucial thing is. And so the process of FISA has been argued by many, especially within the executive branch, especially the senior leaders of the agencies who are trying to get these things sped up, so that, you know, we have a moving target and we have to go through stage after stage after stage after stage of explanation of why we want to do this. Right. And is this the best way to do it? That has been a discussion.
Well, and there are two major acts or bills or programs that have challenged that exact concept. And of course, the Patriot Act is one of the major legislative processes that have taken on the FISA court to a degree. And then the terrorist surveillance program of the Bush administration. Both are an attempt to fix that very problem. Now, how successful they were and is this legit is another question, and we're not going to deal with that. But what are the impact of these two programs or bills, like the Patriot Act, the terrorist surveillance program, on FISA?
Well, we should really separate those two.
Okay.
So the Patriot Act is an act of Congress. It's a different framework for dealing with these types of issues. And that was basically in light of 9/11, it was felt that the operational capability of the security community needed to be opened, so that there needed to be more latitude. And we've talked, I think, in this country a lot about these things. Is it appropriate to gather metadata on people, on Americans? Is it a library record issue from years ago, that type of thing? I think it basically made it easier for the information to be shared between law enforcement and intelligence. There had been a barrier between the two, known as the wall. The wall develops through culture and custom, actually, rather than through a formal edict, that type of thing. But the idea was that, okay, 9/11 was the result of, it is argued, a failure to share this information, that maybe these different pieces of information have been kept separate too long, and that the different purposes of them. So, for example, for law enforcement would be to close a case, to have an arrest and to have prosecution happen, and intelligence, which tends to be longer term with a different intention, which is to gather, perhaps to gather information, usually, or to see how relationships between individuals work, to find an eventual target, to investigate networks, longer term with a different intention in mind. So Patriot Act was effective in terms of, it opened this stuff up. It made it possible for information to be shared across these walls.
There actually have been two reforms passed by Congress directly to try to deal with some of the FISA issues. And one of them was called the Protect America Act in 2007, which I love these. How do you vote against the Protect America Act in 2007? And there was actually the FISA Amendment Act in 2008. Both were intended to take on this perceived problem of taking too much time, of this onerous process to try to get FISA warrants. And a lot of them tackle the issues of the warrantless wiretapping program, for lack of a better word. Maybe that's exactly what you should talk about. And really, that's where the TSP comes into play, is try to get around the FISA restrictions on kind of immediacy. Like, there's a terrorist out there, we think we can find him, do we have time to wait for FISA to get its act together for this process? Can we just jump in without a warrant? And you know, if these tariffs are about to blow something up, I mean, can you talk a little bit about how FISA supposedly is there's a robust body to check and oversight the intelligence community, but there have been many attempts to get around it.
So with the terrorist surveillance program, I don't want to ascribe any malicious intent when it comes to that program. It did happen outside of FISA, and it was basically, one argument is made commonly, that it was to get around these onerous processes. How are we nimble enough to deal with emergent threat, particularly at that time? And I do want to say, at risk of sounding like I am way too friendly with the intelligence community, that this time frame there was a very uncertain time, and there was a sense of extreme threat. So some of these programs that we look back to and say, oh, they were trying to evade certain oversight mechanisms or certain processes, that made sense at the time. So with terrorist surveillance program, they basically, the idea was to speed up the processes, as you suggest.
At this point, we've talked about internal, we talked about all the different branches of external, and I think one of the major points of your book that really comes across, and I applaud you on that, is that it's incredibly complex, that this is not something as black and white as a lot of Americans want to perceive it, not something as black and white as a lot of members of Congress or even people working inside the government perceive it. Like everything else in the world of intelligence, we operate within the gray. And the book itself does come across in your argument. Can you kind of wrap things up and talk a little bit about that complexity?
Right. I think that the complexity of it comes from the fact that we have all of these different pieces of this puzzle. And it gets back to original assumptions. So we have assumptions that only a couple activities are happening, whereas we have 17 agencies that are operating all the time with different missions. They're operating in different levels. We've got other branches of government that are looking into these things too, that we've got this the public reaction to this, the public role, which is something we haven't really talked about too much, that the public actually in some ways is a form of oversight. And the relationship between intelligence and the public is another piece of this puzzle. So yes, there's this large mosaic, of course, of activities, of entities that are operating in this space, but also that there's external and internal dynamics to this. And that is something that I highlight a lot in the book, because I realized in my investigations, we don't explore that enough. We have assumptions that the external committees, for example, in Congress, are the only bodies that are taking responsibility or overseeing or making sure that these bad spies aren't doing bad things, whereas that's not the case. We've got the judiciary that's also helping, and we've got internal mechanisms every step of the way, right, internally to these agencies and internal to the executive branch that are monitoring these activities, because of the fact that there is this tension of, we have operational requirements that require secrecy. We have a mission, or the intelligence, again, too close there to the community. We have, there is a requirement. This is real stuff. And that's, as a political scientist, we tend to get away from what real stuff is sometimes. So this book is, and I mean, we get out in the clouds, we get 30,000 feet up. Right. And what this book is trying to show is, this is a real thing. We have expectations of accountability that our government is open to us as Americans, and we can require them to provide documents and provide more detailed reports on their activities. But we also have a real thing, and that is being kept safe. And the intelligence community is charged with that, and therefore there's a fundamental tension in how that works.
The book is When Should State Secrets Stay Secret? Accountability, Democratic Governance, and Intelligence. The author is Dr. Jen Lester. Thank you, Jen, for taking the time to talk to us at the International Spy Museum.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this author debriefing. We'd like to know if you have any questions or comments about it. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. We look forward to you joining us again for another of our author debriefings. And thanks for listening.